Okay, so the nature of grounding has in the recent discussions of it proved to be rather controversial. A significant number of writers arguing that no sense can be made of it. Among those who do accept that a coherent account of grounding can be given, and is indeed required if we're to properly understand various peculiarly philosophical forms of argumentation, there's nevertheless a significant disagreement about what such an account should look like. In particular, there's much debate over what kind of items the grounding relation relates and just what the logical character of the relation is. The one point that almost all of the proponents of grounding agree on is that it's a non-causal form of determination where the determinable is said to have the feature of interest, to use the phrase universally said to be characteristic of grounding, in virtue of some feature of the determinant. So everybody says, if you want to find a case of grounding, look for the use of the in virtue locution. Where this relationship exists, we may perhaps explain the features of the determinable as grounded in or by those of the determinant. And let me just give you some examples that are cited as instances of grounding. This book, Metaphysical Grounding by Correa and Schneider, they start off by surveying grounding and they give a series of examples of what may turn out to be the grounding relationship. So they say, here are some cases of the priority which they think grounding captures. They say, mental facts obtained because of neurophysiological facts. Legal facts are grounded in non-legal facts. Normative facts are based on natural facts. Meaning is due to non-semantic facts. Dispositional properties are possessed by in virtue of categorical properties. What accounts for the existence of the whole is the existence and arrangement of its parts. A set of things is less fundamental than its members. A substance is prior to its tropes or mode, and they don't mention the notion that in logic, for instance, a disjunction is grounded in its disjuncts. Okay, so all the papers on grounding pretty much start off by giving lists like this and then worry about the nature of the grounding relationship and disagree whether grounding relationship is a relationship between facts or items at a lower level in the ontology and items at a higher level in the ontology and so on, and worry about the exact characteristic, the exact nature of the grounding relationship, that is to say it's the principles which grounding obeys, and then the relationship of grounding to principles of logic in general. Okay, so lots of discussion, and it's become absolutely—you'll know this—it's become absolutely the hot topic. Certainly in the last 5 years, but especially in the last 2 or 3 years, every conference seems to include grounding in its name. A not entirely uncontroversial example to illustrate the relationship is offered by Paul Audi. In an article in the book on metaphysical grounding. He maintains that the dispositional features of things may be grounded in their categorical features. He thus proposes that the question of why a sphere is able to roll may be answered by appealing to its shape, where, he says, being spherical does not cause things to have the power to roll. Like others in these discussions, Audi naturally relies on a contemporary philosophical understanding of causation, about which, again, as you know, there's relatively little unanimity. For our purposes, however, we may assume that it's a relation between spatio-temporally ordered items such as events. This is quite different from the ancient and medieval concept of causation, even when we restrict this to efficient causation, since the cause of an effect in such causation were held to be simultaneous. The example of the dispositional properties of a sphere being explained by its categorical features fits nicely into the ancient and medieval account, however, as an example of formal causation. And so it's not surprising that Aristotle's theory has been invoked as an early recognition of grounding. Again, in these accounts of grounding, they always point to the Euthyphro argument and wave their hands at Aristotle, and that's about it for the historical background, and then they jump on to up to the principle of sufficient reason. Okay, we may certainly read Aristotle in this way, and it's easy to find in him a proponent of grounding, since his account of causation has nothing in it corresponding to the contemporary conception of it, and each of his four causes satisfies at least the minimum requirement for being a grounding relation. Okay. An alternative account, an alternative approach, at least in the medieval history of grounding, is, I think, to consider a relation of determination which played a central role in the medieval theory of argumentation, the notion of a topical warrant, or as we can and probably should say, a topical ground. A ground that is for the truth of a conditional, the validity of an argument, or of one fact being settled non-causally by another. This theory has its origins in Boethius' account of non-syllogistic inference. It was perfected in the first half of the 12th century, before any of Aristotle's works other than the Categories and De Interpretatione were available in Latin, and so in particular before the two analytics, the physics and the metaphysics, with their accounts of causation and explanation, began to prejudice philosophers thinking about these notions. The leading figure in the development of the theory of topics in the 12th century is Peter Abelard, and what I propose to do here is first to say something about his general metaphysical position and the place that one form of grounding plays in it, and then to show how he understands his account of logic to be grounded in that metaphysics in virtue of demonstrable topical principles. So the story is Abelard has a particular take on metaphysics, which I'll sketch out, and then his account of logic can be understood to be related to his metaphysics in terms of grounding. Okay, so part one, grounding in Abelard's metaphysics. So if you look at the handout, let's begin by considering the small corner of the world inhabited by Sophroniscus, his son Socrates, and their long-suffering ass Brunellus. I say long-suffering because Brunellus appears throughout the Middle Ages as the example of a non-human animal. According to Abelard, the ontologically curious who focus their attention here, or indeed anywhere else in the world, will discover only individuals. They will, however, find a very large number of them, and included will be the 17 distinct items illustrated. Three of them are substances, and 14 are individual accidents. Five of the accidents are properties, that is, they're inseparable from the substances which are their subject, and are instances of the kinds of accidents found only in each and every member of the species. So what do I have in here? I have the ability to laugh and the ability to sail. Those are properties. The nine remaining accidents are separable from their subjects in the sense that they may cease to be present without the destruction of these subjects. Abelard is developing this theory principally on the basis of reading Porphyry's Isagoge and Boethius' commentary on it, but developing an enormously sophisticated theory on the basis of what is a very rudimentary account in Boethius. Abelard explains that the expression, you see brightness attached to Sophroniscus, the expression "this bright thing" applies to this whiteness in virtue of the brightness informing it. Whence the name brightness, which is a form only of whiteness, applies to it alone and not also to body. Accidental forms may thus themselves be informed by, and so be the subject for accidental forms. Where Abelard makes a distinction between the relationship which an accident has to its immediate subject and that which it has to the subject of that subject, if there is one. Following Aristotle, individual accidents are defined as items which are neither said of nor in a subject. Accidents inform their subjects immediately and at the same time stand to the underlying substance in a relationship which Abelard characterizes as being sustained by them. A form of dependence in which a substance provides the fundamentum, the foundation for the accidental forms which rest upon it, and for any accidental forms which inform those accidental forms. It seems then that not only do we have a clear relation of grounding in Abelard's ontology, but also that he himself uses the terminology of grounding to characterize it. Sustaining is surely grounding, and a foundation provides the ground for the superstructure that it sustains. So the substance sustains the accidents and the accidents of the accidents. Something is thus colored in virtue of being a body. Its being a body grounds its being coloured, and it is coloured because it is a body. All of the locutions which are taken to characterise grounding. We'll see below, however, that matters are rather more complicated, since Abelard recognises two different kinds of ontologically significant dependence, both of which may be understood as forms of grounding, on this particular idea of grounding as explicating or the appropriate way to characterise the relationship of a substance to the various features that it has. According to Abelard, an accident of an accident informs that accident as its subject, but does not inform the substance, which is the subject of the informed accident. For him, then, unlike Aristotle, an accident of an accident is not merely a coincident accident of the underlying substance, as in the case of the white musical, or the white, where it looks as if the musical is white, is really just locating two coincident accidents in an underlying substance. It's not locating a genuine accident of something which is accidental. A theory of that form is precluded once Aristotle's Abelard's metaphysics is received. We can't have genuine accidents of accidents. The relationship of information is, Abelard's account of it, is intransitive, and this explains for Abelard the incongruity of a claim such as "this body is bright," hoc corpus est clarum. An accident of an accident is, however, sustained by the substance which sustains the accident which informs it. And in general, the underlying substance sustains anything which informs something which it sustains. So sustaining, as grounding is supposed to be, is transitive. Any change at any level, any change in information at any level of Abelard's hierarchy of grounding entails, he holds, a change in the foundation. And that's in passage number 2, he says, "For it's possible for this body to be varied with respect to blackness and whiteness in such a way that nothing else is changed, for it may lose whiteness and take on blackness in such a way that nothing else is changed with it. But if whiteness is changed with respect to darkness or brightness, or if any form is varied in some way, it's necessary that with this form something else is changed. That is both it and at least its subject substance. For if whiteness should become different by being bright at one time and dark at another, then the substance would be different by having at one time whiteness, at one time bright whiteness, and at the other dark whiteness." Abelard doesn't discuss how long the chain of information might be, and so how far this kind of grounding might extend. But he does perhaps allow that there might be at least one more link, since he holds that, and remember, all along, Abelard is an anti-realist. There's no universals in his theory, so every explanation has to appeal to an individual item. So he holds that the contrary opposition of whiteness and blackness is perhaps due to the relational accident of contrariness informing each of them. So there's an accident of brightness and darkness. For Abelard, relations are what we might call individual directed accidents, each informing a single substance, one for each relata, or a single substratum, one for each relata, each of these, as it were, indexed to the other relata. With nothing else required is an ontology to explain the opposition of contrary accidents. But brightness and darkness are also contraries, so it would seem there must be accidents of accidents of accidents. So there's the individual contrariness in virtue of which the brightness of this whiteness is contrary to the darkness of that whiteness. So he at least seems to allow one more step in this hierarchy. Each of the items in our diagram, as I said, is held by Abelard to be utterly and uncompromisingly individual. Abelard's individual accidental forms are what we now call abstract particulars or tropes. If you hadn't guessed that already, they are ontologically entirely simple, since there are, he holds, on pain of an infinite regress, no differentiae in the 9 accidental categories. The category of quality, for example, consists of all the individual accidents of quality, colours, sounds, smells, and so on, as well as the individual substantial differentiae, united together in the category into species and genera by their varying degrees of resemblance to one another. Individual substances, on the other hand, are, according to Abelard, ontologically complex. They are, as we would say, hylomorphic composites of an ultimate individual subject with individual differentiating substantial forms. Abelard provides us with two accounts of the origins of the individual corporeal substances which populate the world, one physical and the other metaphysical. In the physical account, in his commentary on the Hexameron, a theological work, he describes the process by which God, starting from a confused mixture of the four elements, imposes form by the infusion of substantial forms into individual bodies to produce individual substances of all the various natural kinds. That's the story of creation. In the metaphysical account of the same process, when he turns his philosophical attention to it, Abelard refers to the original creation of the ultimate matter of individuals as first creation, and to the adjunction or infusion of substantial forms to this matter as second creation. God is entirely responsible for both, and indeed, according to Abelard, for all later generation of creatures. In second creation, God, for example, adjoins the individual substantial forms of animateness, sensibleness, mortalness, and rationalness to an individual parcel of corporeal matter to produce an individual human being. And in a very brief discussion of the four Aristotelian causes, Abelard notes that these forms are the formal causes of the substance which they constitute. Although Abelard does not characterize them in this way, the individual substantial forms which constitute an individual substance, such as Socrates, are thus sustained by the individual package of corporeal matter, whose dimension, shape, weight, and so on are accidental forms. So you have a nice story about how the world comes to be as it is in the act of creation. God determines the ontological structure of each individual of any natural kind. And this is nice because we can now classify Abelard's ontology rather neatly. He's a tropal anti-realist of what, following Peter Simons, we might call the nuclear persuasion. Unlike Simons, however, he's not a bundler, but rather insists that there's an ultimate substratum which grounds all the other tropes. Socrates is this body informed by this animateness, this sensibleness, this rationalness, and this mortalness, the nucleus of his essential tropes. The individual substantial forms which constitute him as this very human being. To Socrates, there adhere a vast number of individual accidental tropes, each grounded in his substantial structure at some level. His being coloured again is thus completely grounded in his being a body, while his being white is partially grounded there, the remainder of the grounding coming from the individual accidents of whiteness which inhere in his body. Socrates is white because he's a body, and thereby coloured, a body in which there inhere individual whitenesses. The familiar objects in the of our experience are exposed in the diagram of composites of an ultimate corporeal substratum to which there are adjoined essential and accidental tropes. We may distinguish Socrates by his perceptible accidents, his baldness, snub nose, pot belly, and so on. But Socrates himself, Abelard insists, has his identity independently of each and all of them, since all of these features, and any more we might think of, would be had by his exactly identical twin brother. And some at least of them are not possessed by Socrates throughout his life. Socrates is no more and no less, according to Abelard, than the individual human substance underlying these accidents. He differs essentialiter, as Abelard says, that's existentially or numerically from Plato, simply in being this human as opposed to that one, this animal as opposed to that one, and so on. Thus, Abelard claims, in passage number 3, that to be an individual consists only in personal distinctness. That is to say that a thing is in itself one, distinct from all others, and with all accidents removed, it would remain itself, always personally one. Nor would it become other, nor any less this human being, if all its accidents were taken away, so that, for example, it were not this bald man or this snub-nosed man. And so, in passage number 4, in this fashion, we take the two names Socrates and this human being to be entirely the same, and maintain that they are designative of no accidents of Socrates, but designate only the substance of a human being in its personal distinctness. Despite only ever actually occurring in adjacents, however, individual accidents are ontologically distinct. In one striking aside, indeed, Abelard is apparently prepared even to allow a considerable degree of ontological independence to the individual of whiteness that happens to inhere in Socrates. It might thus be, he tentatively suggests, that while this individual whiteness now in Socrates cannot now or at any later time inform something other than Socrates, it might nevertheless, before it supervened on Socrates, have gone to Plato. It's a very strange view. While Abelard will not allow a promiscuous exchange of tropes, he'll thus apparently countenance the possibility that Socrates might have had the whiteness that Plato does in fact have, and vice versa. And as he says in passage number 7, it might perhaps happen that though this whiteness in fact went to this subject, it might have gone to another, and have always been in that other, in such a way that it never came to this subject. But nature cannot allow that if it now inheres in the one, it is at some time in the other. That is, it cannot change its subject by passing from one to the other. Abelard thus seems to suppose here that an accidental form could be an individual whose individuation is independent of its bearer, but once it finds a home in that bearer, it cannot move out without ceasing to exist. This is a strange and apparently ad hoc claim for which no further justification is forthcoming. And indeed elsewhere he says that accidents come into existence in their subjects. Abelard's gloss on Aristotle's definition of accident seems to require that individual accidents undergo an entirely mysterious change in coming to inhere in their subjects, a change which renders them unable to leave those subjects without them ceasing to exist. Worse, the suggestion that accidents may in some sense be individuated apart from the substances that they finally inform seems to be entirely at odds with Abelard's holding as a fundamental principle of ontology that substances are prior to accidents. So it's a very puzzling aspect of his theory. If Abelard's commitment to the possibilities open to his accidental tropes is perhaps less than certain, there's no doubt at all that he allows and indeed requires them to be piled upon one another in order at least to increase the intensity of a quality. Thus he notes in a series of rather charming passages that if we repeatedly dip a piece of bread into a cup of wine, it becomes redder and redder as a greater thickness of individual rednesses accumulate on its surface. And this will be familiar to readers of David Armstrong as the notion of piling tropes. And he says that in passage 8, nature too operates in this way in giving flowers their colours. For on the first day it clothes a lily with a layer of whiteness, but does not render it very coloured, until as time goes by it piles on other layers of whiteness. And as the lily receives more parts of whiteness by superimposition, it is said to be more white and more coloured. Abelard supposes further that where there's an individual... Abelard supposes further that where there's an individual oneness or unity trope which makes what is one to be one, and that everything except a oneness trope is accompanied by a oneness trope. So wherever you got one something, that oneness is associated... is determined by the presence there of a oneness trope. Every indivisible point of a substantial body and every individual accident located at a point in a body or in some other way adhering to a particular individual. While a oneness trope itself, he argues, is one It's not, however, made to be so by another oneness trope, so there's no regress, and the stacking is of oneness tropes. When you stack whitenesses to produce a more intense white, the example he explicitly discusses, produces no increase in unity. Okay, so there's a single white, even though I've piled lots of individual whitenesses on top of one another, each of them is accompanied by its oneness trope, which makes it the individual one that it is. The piling of all of these doesn't mean there's any more than one instance of the overall whiteness. Unlike Occam, Abelard's anti-realism doesn't extend to a radical or even a moderate reduction of the varieties of accidental forms. He assumes, rather, that many and perhaps all of the nine accidental categories consist of individual accidental forms. Thus, in his ontological inventory, we encounter individual tropes of quantity, quality, place, time, relation, and being in a position. It's an odd one. For Abelard's theory of inference, what's crucial is the difference between the constitution of substances by substantial forms and their relationships to the accidents which they sustain, which include their relations to other substances. Between Socrates and Brunellus the ass, the relationship of that is that of complete independence. Each may cease to exist while the other continues to exist. They are, however, as Abelard will say, as opposites. It's not possible for something to be both a man and an ass. A lesser degree of independence holds between Socrates and his whiteness. His whiteness may cease to exist while Socrates remains, but his accidental forms cannot, as we've now seen, naturally exist in a subject other than Socrates. The relationship between Socrates and his property of being able to laugh is yet closer. For Socrates cannot lose this ability without ceasing to exist. Indeed, it's simply not possible for there to be a human being without the ability to laugh. Whether God could make such a being was an interesting question in 14th century philosophy, theology. For many contemporary philosophers, this connection between them, between Socrates and his ability to laugh, would be necessary and sufficient for the inclusion of the ability of part of what it is as part of what it is to be a human being. Mutual inseparability is all that's required for the truth of the biconditional or strict implication that something is a human being if and only if it's able to laugh. For Abelard, however, while this kind of inseparability is necessary, it's not sufficient for the truth of a conditional. This is because it is with true conditionals that we express what he calls laws of nature or laws of natures. Statements which explicate the constitutive structure of natural kinds, and in doing so capture the second grounding relationship which is found in his work. The order observed by God in the constitution of an individual of a natural kind is the order of natural priority required for this grounding relationship. The expression of it in what Abelard calls a natural consequence reverses the order. What is prior follows in the corresponding conditional from what is posterior. Thus, according to Abelard, it's true that if something is human, then it is rational, because being rational partially grounds being human. The complete ground for something's being human is that it has the nature which it does, where this consists of being a body with all the constitutive differentiae required in order to be a human. And at this point, his view differs from contemporary theorists in general of grounding, who think that the grounding relation, if it's expressed in the conditional, must be in a unidirectional conditional. Whereas Abelard would certainly hold that something's a human if and only if it's a whatever the full definition of it is a human is. So, I'm not clear whether on this point he would simply say, but being the definition grounds being a human, rather than being a human grounding the definition. The additional requirements the conditionals must satisfy in order to express laws of nature is central to Abelard's account of the metaphysical foundations of his logic, so let me now turn to that. Okay, so that's the general outline of Abelard's metaphysics, trying to show how the various components fit together as an and to show that he certainly does have something like the notion of grounding. So the terminology is going to be, I mean, the terminology in the first part was relatively familiar in cast in terms of tropes. I'm now going to have to refer to the terminology of medieval topical theory, which is less familiar. Okay, so the development of the theory of the topics from Aristotle to Boethius is complicated and rather obscure. Boethius provided the Middle Ages with a commentary on Cicero's topics and a work of his own called On Topical Differences, De Differentiis Topicis. And this latter was the most important logical text in the first half of the 12th century. So the beginning of the 12th century is quite unique in this respect, in which some later in the Middle Ages, Aristotle's Prior Analytics, and then the various accounts of the Logica Modernorum, the theory of consequences, and so on, would be central in logic. But for the first half of the 12th century, they don't have the Prior Analytics. They have some very elementary texts from Boethius on the syllogism, and they have quite a lot of material on non-syllogistic inference. In Boethius' book On Topical Differences, he proposes an account of how we can discover arguments to settle any given question. What he says we have to do is to go to places, the loci, or the loci differentiae, which are items such as definition, species, and contrary, and so on, and locate features of the items about which the question is asked, which might provide us with an argument to settle it. So the idea is you have a question, how do I answer the question? I locate some feature of the items in question, perhaps their definitions, which will enable me to construct an argument to settle the question. The general idea of such a difference, and indeed some of the differences, are already present in Aristotle's rhetoric, but it's in De Differentiis Topicis, they're presented as systematically organized into two different classifications, one due to Themistius ultimately and the other due to Cicero. Each classification distinguishes between features of the thing itself, such as its definition, features associated with it in some way, such as its genus or its four causes, and in addition, arguments can be drawn upon resources extrinsic to what is in question, appealing, for example, to an argument from authority. So if you can't do any better than this, you go and ask a philosopher for the answer to the question. Okay, with each of these items, these loci, Boethius associates what he calls maximal propositions. Axiomata is the original Greek notion. They're general principles which can either actually be used in the argument to draw a desired conclusion, or more importantly, they may warrant the inference. They may allow us to say, I can infer that this follows from that because, and so they ground the argument. Such propositions are not part of Aristotle's topical theory, and Tobias Reinhardt has argued that they seem to have their origins in Galen's theory of the relational syllogism. Whatever the source, Boethius directly connects maximal propositions with syllogisms in the opening lines of his book by stating that he plans to show what these loci are, definition, genus, species, so on, opposite, and which of them are appropriate for constructing which syllogisms. And he proceeds to do the latter by showing how the inferential power manifests in a second figure syllogism is provided for it by the maximal proposition things whose definitions are different are themselves different. So if you want to prove that an animal isn't a tree, you say, or a man isn't a tree, you say a man is a mortal rational animal, a tree is a irrational, whatever the definition of a tree is, something covered in bark, and then you appeal to the general proposition, the maximal proposition, things whose definitions are different are themselves different. But he presents this as a second figure syllogism. So it looks as if you're justifying your use of a syllogism by appeal to this maximal proposition. More often, however, His examples are of conditional propositions. He justifies a conditional claim if something's human, then it's an animal, by appealing to the general proposition of what the species is predicated, the genus is predicated. So we have these general principles used to justify the assertion of particular conditional sentences. And it's this latter formulation which is crucial for Abelard in his development of the theory of the hypothetical syllogism. His general discussion of inference and conditional propositions is strikingly characterized by his insistence that we must distinguish between the necessity which connects the premises and conclusion of a valid argument from the necessity which is required to connect the antecedent and consequent of a true conditional. For an argument to be valid, it must, Abelard agrees, be necessarily truth-preserving. But for this, all that's required is that it's not possible for the premises all to be true, and the conclusion false at the same time. For a conditional to be true, on the other hand, it must be such in addition to its not being possible for the consequent to be false when the antecedent is true, the meaning of the antecedent contains that of the consequent. So it's a hyper-intentional relationship. And again, accounts of contemporary accounts of grounding have wanted to say that grounding is not a modal relationship, it's a hyper-intentional relationship. And we find precisely that distinction insisted upon by Abelard. A distinction between a conditional, the mere inseparability of the consequent from the antecedent and the relationship of containment, which he insists has to hold in addition for a conditional to be true. A true conditional is thus what we would now characterize as an analytic truth. And so, if we identify logical truth with analytic truth, Abelard's position is that logical truth requires more than is required for valid inference. And from what I said above, the natural consequence with its converse constitutive grounding is a logical relationship. So he includes in logic these ground, as we'll see, these grounded conditionals. Abelard characterizes the connection which holds between the antecedent of a true conditional and its consequence as inferentia, and I translate that as entailment. The weaker sort of necessity required for validity produces conditionals which are not true, but which, according to Abelard, nevertheless have maximal probability. He means by that something like, you'll never go wrong in an argument if you argue from something's being a human that it's not an ass. But as we'll see, he doesn't think the conditional, if something's a human, then it's not an ass, is true. I mean, his great project, and it is truly a great project in his treatise on the topics, is to determine just which principles provide us with entailments and which with the conditionals which are not entailments. Okay, so he thinks, which with connections which can't be captured in true conditionals. A conditional, as I said, expresses an entailment, according to Abelard, just in case the truth of the antecedent, he says, requires that of the consequent, because the meaning of the antecedent contains that of the consequent. And this is his own language. He talks about containment and requiring, and it's exactly the same language you see in 20th century accounts of relevant logic. And the grounding relationship is surely going to be a relevant relationship of some kind. The condition may be met simply, he holds, by the construction or form of the antecedent, guaranteeing that if it is true, then so is the consequent. In which case, he says that the entailment is perfect because nothing further is required to ground its truth. In particular, there's no locus, no item from this list that Boethius gave us, and no. There's no locus to warrant it, and no maximal proposition is needed, though the general form of a syllogism may be expressed as rules, he says. So there's no locus like definition or opposite or whatever that we can appeal to to justify our assertion of a conditionalized syllogism. Okay, so this is what goes over into the far left box. Alternatively, the truth of a conditional may be guaranteed to hold by a locus differentia and a maximal proposition. And these provide what Abelard calls the vis inferentiae, which has to be translated as the ground for entailment. Okay, so we have these general propositions which we can use if we want to assert conditional sentences. This is his definition of a topical locus, a ground that is which guarantees that the character of the antecedent and consequent is such that if the former is true, then so is the latter. And in this case, he says the entailment is imperfect. And very, very strikingly, Abelard explains this distinction in just the way, well, in terms of substitution. There's absolutely no logical difference for him between perfect and imperfect entailments. They're equally necessary, but their necessity is in the one case guaranteed by their form, and in the other by what we would call a conceptual, or better, a metaphysical truth. Perfect entailments are such that they hold for all uniform substitutions of general terms, while imperfect entailments hold only for the substitution of general terms or of propositions related in a particular way. Thus, according to Abelard in passage number 9, if every animal is an animate being, and every animate being is an animate being, then every animal is an animate being. The entailment is perfect in virtue of its form. That is clear from the fact that the entailment is perfect in itself, not in virtue of the nature of the terms, which are such that whatever terms you substitute, whether they are compatible or incompatible, there's no way to invalidate the consecution, his word for the conditional. In other true consequences, of which the entailment depends on the nature of thing, do not remain true for all terms, but only for those which preserve the nature of the consecution. So true conditionals, such as if Socrates is a human being, then he's an animal, thus rely on the fact that a human is a species of animal for the support of the locus from a species with its maximal proposition of whatever a species is predicated, so is its genus, expressing a metaphysical truth about the structure of substance. Indeed, in medieval discussions, someone will assert if something's a human, then it's an animal, and the opponent says, unde locus, what's your justification for that? And you'll say, from species, and then you'll explain that the relations of species to genus is such that of whatever the species is predicated, the genus is predicated. So the general proposition provides a justification for the assertion of a partial justification, at least, for the assertion of a particular conditional. Despite, however, characterizing perfect entailments in his introductory remarks as those which hold for all uniform substitutions of general terms, and repeating this claim later without suggesting that there are any exceptions, Abelard shows in his examples that he limits perfection to the instances of the canonical forms of the categorical and hypothetical syllogisms and their conditionalization. So he doesn't get to the full definition of validity in terms of uniform substitution preserving validity, or no uniform substitution being unable to produce a counter instance that was developed in the 19th and the 20th century. But he's very close, he's almost there, and it's not clear why he thinks that definition only applies to the categorical and hypothetical syllogisms. Okay, Abelard's account of the loci drawn from Boethius' lists as of particular concern to logicians produces the result that of those loci which provide general principles governing the relationship between the kinds of things signified by the antecedent of a conditional and those signified by the consequent, only those which have to do solely with the nature of the thing in which we are interested can ground an imperfect entailment. Such conditionals express, as I said, a law of nature and a natural consecution, and the maximal propositions which ground them explicate the metaphysics of substantial constitution. So these guys are ungrounded, these are hold merely in virtue of their forms, And these guys, if something's a human, then it's an animal, they are grounded. There's a justification for them in these general propositions about the nature of species and genus. And these general propositions explicate Abelard's the ontological structure that Abelard takes substances to have. Okay, and in the items on the far right then, and imperfect entailments, thus hold where the relationships which relate the terms of the antecedent and consequent have to do appropriately with the definition or definitional components of the kind of thing with which these propositions are concerned. If Socrates is a human, for example, then he's an animal, is an imperfect entailment. But if Socrates is a human being, then he's not an ass, is not. The corresponding maximal proposition of what one of a pair of opposites is predicated, the other is removed, does not, according to Abelard, ground logical truths, laws of nature. It's not a law of nature that if something's a human, it's not an ass. There's nothing contained in the sense of being a human which precludes Socrates being an ass. And indeed, Abelard thinks that all natures are characterized entirely positively. There's nothing negative in a nature. So, imperfect entailments, on the other hand, are truths grounded by the metaphysical relationship of substantial constitution. Their truth conditions add to truth, as we would say, in every possible world, the hyperintentional requirement that the meaning of the antecedent includes that of the consequent. Surprisingly, at least on first reading, Abelard holds that the maximal proposition of whatever a definition is predicated, the defined term is predicated, is false, and that the corresponding conditionals are not logical truths, and so are not true at all. Though he accepts that the maximal proposition does have maximal probability or plausibility, this is because a definition, for example, of a human being as a mortal rational animal provides us with an expression necessarily, in the strict sense, coextensive with man, but not hyperintentionally equivalent because it omits substantial differentiae required for thee to be a man. As he tells us in passage number 10, he says, just as a human being cannot exist without rationalness or mortalness, so it cannot exist without the rest of the substantial differences. For when animal is formed into human, it's necessary that it be invested with all the forms of a human. Someone, whoever, who says mortal, rational, animal, adding only those forms of a human, says only animal with those forms added, without which a human cannot exist. It's not therefore necessary that if something is a mortal, rational, animal, that is, an animal with these two forms added, it's a human being. As I remarked above, Abelard insists that no locus is needed to guarantee the items on the far left, the conditionalization of a categorical or hypothetical syllogism. It is, however, crucial for him that the conditionalization is formed in the appropriate way. In general, he argues, a categorical proposition does not entail a conditional proposition, the only exceptions being if the antecedent categorical proposes that one of the constitutive relationships exists. For example, if animal is the genus of human being, then if something is a human being, then it's an animal. It follows that all conditionalizations of categorical and hypothetical syllogisms of this form are false. The conditional formulation of a syllogism, which Abelard does accept, uses the copulative conjunction and to combine the premises of the syllogism to form the antecedent of a conditional with the conclusion as its consequent. He thus cannot accept the logical principle of exportation, which would allow him to export one of the antecedent conjuncts to form the equivalent conditional with categorical antecedent and conditional consequence. Since the antecedent of Abelard's conditional syllogism is a compound of two propositions, it does not have a single subject or predicate which might provide a thing or locus to guarantee the truth of the conditional, and as we've seen, Abelard holds that such conditionals do not require the aid of a locus of any sort. Okay, so strikingly, Abelard and his followers reject Boethius's claim that syllogisms can be warranted by appeal to topical principles. And that's included among the list of theses which Abelard and his school accepted, which you find in some 12th century texts. Okay, a little bit more, and then I'll be done. In addressing the question of why Boethius claims that such principles do support syllogisms, I'd offer at examples which purport to show it. Abelard suggests that what he had in mind was perhaps that the loci concerned warrant an enthymematic inference which could then be used to support the claim that a given syllogism is valid. To justify this suggestion, he introduces a crucial principle for his logic in both its general and particular form, and that's in passage number 11, which is one of the most important, I think, passages in the history of logic. He says, "For where a simple entailment holds, who could not even more so accept a corresponding composite entailment? For the composite entailment can necessarily be proved from the simple. For if every human being is an animal, then every human being is animate is true. For if that's true, then it's necessary that the entailment of a syllogism is true. That is, if every human being is an animal and every animal is animate, then every human being is animate. For what follows from the consequent follows from the antecedent, and those two propositions together, taken together, are antecedent to each of them taken separately." Here we have stated for the first time, I think, in European logic, both the general principle of strengthening the antecedent or monotonicity and the particular case of conditionalized simplification, as well as an appeal to transitivity. Abelard does not indicate what status these principles have, but we must assume that he regards them as logical truths. Just what kind of logical truth, however, is not immediately obvious. Okay, as I noted in passing above, Abelard holds that in addition to the loci, which are characterized things and their features, there are also loci and maximal propositions which ground entailments between whole propositions. These are the guys in the middle of the diagram at the bottom. The locus for an antecedent and a consequent, indeed, Abelard insists, must be understood in this way if we're to be able to understand the logic of conditional propositions. The locus for an antecedent, however, is, he notes, entirely empty, since someone who does not accept that P entails Q will not be convinced by its being pointed out to him that P is antecedent to Q. I mean, if I say P entails Q, and you say, why? And I say, well, the locus from an antecedent, P is antecedent to Q. It's just to repeat the same claim. But there are propositional principles which have more content, the principles of contraposition, for instance, and transitivity, and on there I put conversion and simplification. In addition to these, Abelard holds that the equivalence of propositions is a topical relationship, he says in passage number 12. There is a locus with respect to the whole antecedent propositions when one says, if every human is an animal, every non-animal is a non-human. If no human is a stone, then no stone is a human. If because Socrates is a human, Socrates is an animal, then because Socrates is not an animal, Socrates is not a human. For the whole antecedent proposition is related to the whole consequent proposition by being equipollent. So to justify my assertion of the second of these conditionals, I would say in virtue of their equipollence. Note that like repetition, all of these conditionals holds for all substitutions of terms, propositional terms, and indeed for categorical terms. And Abelard could certainly associate repetition with the locus from an equal if he wished to do so. Unfortunately, he doesn't say any more about the conversion of quantified categorical propositions, or indeed any reason for characterizing syllogisms as perfect and complexional, while conversion is imperfect and local. Well, in effect, he doesn't tell us why he thinks that These kinds of forms are ungrounded, but these which satisfy the same principles of substitution are grounded, and they require the same kind of support as these principles, as these conditionals. So he doesn't provide any reason for the one being ungrounded and the other grounded in the maximal proposition. Though not in one would seem, which he would suppose to express a metaphysical truth. So these last ones are grounded in principles which tell us something about the structure of the world. These are just relations between propositions, so these seem to be very different from those. And finally then, nowhere, as far as I know, does Abelard classify the principle of conditional simplification, the one that I've just mentioned. Given what he says about his remarks given what he says about repetition and his remarks on the propositional loci, it's hard, however, to suppose that he would not classify it too as imperfect and so as topically grounded, even though it holds for all substitutions of terms here. P and if P and Q then P, then whatever you substitute for P and Q, you won't invalidate that conditional, but Abelard doesn't characterize it in terms of satisfying the uniform substitutability principle. But it doesn't really matter, since he clearly supposes that it's a logical truth in just the way as if something is a human being, then it's an animal is logically true, as are all instances of contraposition and transitivity. And it's because of this, in another story, that he left himself no room for escape from a series of arguments which would be directed at his logic by philosophers in the middle of the 12th century. The results of these debates about Abelard's logic and the reception of Aristotle's remaining logical works brought with it profound changes in logic. In the theory of inference, in particular, there was a move away from a hyperintentional account of the conditional to something corresponding to our strict implication. Discussions of the topics were no longer central to logic, but the basic definitions established by Abelard were retained. His work may well represent a high point in the history of grounding, but that history has yet to be written, and the medievals will surely play a large part in it. And earlier, Anna asked me why I was interested in the development of logic, and I think that, I tried to say something about it here. It's a wonderfully complex story.